Breaking It Down with Frank McKay. This is 103.9 LI News Radio.
I'd like to welcome everyone to Breaking It Down. Frank McKay here. So much more importantly, a man who's had an incredible career, both as a musician and as a producer and everything that comes along with that. Steve Katz. You know his work from Blood, Sweat, and Tears and American Flyer and, you know, so much out there as a guitarist, as a producer. Lou Reed, as a solo artist, really didn't hit it big until Steve Katz came in contact with him and he put together some legendary albums. And I'm thrilled to have Steve Katz with us. Steve, how are you?
Good, Frank. Thank you. How are you?
I'm doing great. And if you don't mind, let's do a little bit of your history. Upstate New York, right? Is that where it all started out for you?
Well, I lived there between the ages of 10 and 15 up in Schenectady, New York.
Yeah. Where were you born?
I was born in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
I was raised in the New York area, but those 5 years in Schenectady, which I refer to as my pubic years, were very formative for me.
Yeah, is that the first time you picked up a guitar somewhere in that time period?
I think it was afterwards when my family moved back down to Long Island, 1960, and that's when I really got involved in listening to a lot of country blues and hanging out in Greenwich Village, even though I was like a 15-year-old.
Yeah, a different time period. Actually, looking back, a historic time period. And in some ways, I don't know that enough is talked about what happened there and how formative that was for so many different folks. But if you can do a little bit of your background, and if you can go into who specifically. I know you mentioned some country music and that type of things, but a specific guitarist hit you?
Well, in those, yes, I think when I started listening to country blues and going into the Village, I was listening to Robert Johnson, the great King of the Delta Blues album that Columbia Records put out. And when I went into the Village, I would go down to the Gaslight Cafe and see all of these wonderful people like Tom Paxton and John Hammond. But the guy I really, really loved was Dave Van Ronk. And I asked Dave if he gave lessons, so I took lessons from Dave for about 2.5 years.
Wow, nice first teacher. That was your first teacher?
That was my first teacher, yeah. Along with Reverend Gary Davis, I took some lessons from Reverend Davis as well.
You know, I imagine most 15-year-olds were listening to, more straight ahead rock. I mean, Elvis, and I'm sure you listened to it as well. But Elvis, and
yeah, no, during the day, I would hang out with my friends and listen to the Shirelles, and at night, I would have this other life listening to acoustic guitar, being played country blues style.
Yeah, I mean, at what point do you figure you could make a living at it? I mean, you're surrounded by folks, or you're watching people that are doing it for a living, or at least partially for a living. It probably wasn't much of a stretch for you to say, hey, this is a lifestyle. This is something I could do.
Yeah, well, actually, I'm still trying to figure that out.
It's not
something that I would recommend for everybody.
Well, I think it's different now, too. I mean, it's a different world. I mean, easier or harder now?
No, it's much harder now. There was a time when it was easier to get a record deal. There were venues all over the place, and now the venues are gone because of the gentrification of the neighborhoods. For instance, in the Village, or the whole Little Italy area where the Village was, there's no clubs or anything. There's very few clubs in any of the major cities now. And without that, without the venues, there's really no reason for kids to get into music if they can't make a living, I think there's a lot of kids out there. There's a lot of like John Lennons and Pete Townsends out there that just would say to themselves, well, I can't make a living doing this. There aren't the venues or the record companies, and the distribution for your music is very difficult these days. So it's not something that I would recommend unless you're totally devoted to making music.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point. Steve Katz is the voice you're hearing, in case you're just joining us or you're just turning on your radio a little late. Wonderful guitarist and producer, a musician, wonderful. career singer.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, listen, I 99.9% of the people, even back then, would change places with you as far as the career that you've put together. I mean, it's really it's mind blowing if you think about it. And
well, I was very lucky. I was living in a time around all of that stuff that was happening. I met tons of people and great musicians and really creative people, and went through some pretty amazing times, you know, the 60s, and had some hit records and stuff like that. So yeah, I think in that sense I was very lucky.
We spoke about, and you just mentioned how hard it is to make a living now, and I guess when Napster came around, it forget it. I mean, then theft of music was okay, and everyone's just illegally downloading everything and everything that comes along with all of that. But at the same time, somehow or another, if you're not signed to a record label, it's hard to tell that you're not, because there's so much DIY stuff out there, and everything that made it hard to make a living is making it easy for people to get a little bit of notice. Now, I don't know if that notice is able to be monetized by modern standards, but back then, it was a lot harder to get noticed. You needed a record deal. When was the first time you got a record deal?
The first time was when I was with my first band was the Even Dozen Jug Band. And, all you had to do is bicycle down to the village to one of our rehearsals, and bring a record contract with you, and we were there, And that's basically what happened with Elektra Records. It's a very small community, and Elektra had a lot of our folk music people and friends of ours, and there was another jug band out of Cambridge that was signed to Vanguard called the Jim Queskin Jug Band, and we were the New York jug band, so that was the first actual professional record that I did.
What did your folks do for a living?
My father was a car salesman. My mother was a housewife and a pain in the ass. A housewife.
I've got to believe they were just holding their breath on this whole thing, thinking, "Oh, Steve, what are you doing? Going into the village, playing."
Well, when I decided to become a rock and roll musician and join the Blues Project and dropped out of college, my parents just didn't want to talk to me until I had the first hit single with Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and then my mother called me and said, "Steven, we knew it all along."
We were behind you every step of the way.
They were thrilled. Yeah, they wanted me to be not just a doctor; they wanted me to be a lawyer and a doctor. So. The pressure was too great, so I just went out and bought a pair of bell bottoms and got myself a Les Paul and started playing music.
Did you have siblings?
Yes.
And one brother. Was he a musician?
No, lawyer.
Lawyer. All right. Well, listen, he made your mom proud, right off the bat, going right for that.
It took some of the pressure off.
Yeah. How many times did you hear, "Steven, you're killing me. You're absolutely killing me with this guitar"?
Well, I heard that probably every week up until I was 16 years old. Not just the guitar, you're killing me by God knows what. Yeah.
What does it do to you? Now you've had enough time where you could kind of look back while it's going on. I mean, you could be defiant and you could be tough about it, and you're surrounded by friends that are hearing the same thing from their parents. But looking back, what do you think that did to you? I mean, even creatively. I mean, does it force you to bear down and to get into it? Does it have any effect on you? It's got to have some effect. I mean, you're getting pressured to do something else, and you're kind of blowing it off and doing your own thing. I imagine it's got to be empowering.
Yeah, well, it was. It wasn't. I didn't really feel that much pressure. As far as I just felt that I wanted to be a musician, and that was it. Once you make up your mind for something, to do something, then, I felt that when I left school that I wasn't going to make a penny for the rest of my life, but at least I was able to play music. And that, that changed, because like with Napster, I was able to make one penny. In fact, that's exactly what I made. But that really takes the pressure off when you do what you love, and in that sense, I feel like I was really lucky to be able to be part of the arts.
Yeah. Well, Steve Katz is the voice you're hearing. Once again, Frank McKay reminding everyone, wonderful producer and the guitarist, Blood, Sweat, and Tears. And
don't forget, I'm an author now, Frank. My book is out if you want to read more about this stuff.
Yeah, well, let's talk about your book a little bit. And again, Frank McKay here with author, guitarist, vocalist, and producer Steve Katz. Let's talk about your book and let everyone know where you can get it and give the proper name. And pardon me for my shoddy research here, give us the name.
The name of the book is Blood, Sweat, and My Rock and Roll Years, and the subtitle is Steve Katz a Rock Star? And it's actually the best place to get it is on my website. Because I sign it, you know, and people order it from my website, and I do sign it. I don't sign it on, you can get it at Amazon, but I don't sign anything from Amazon. But anyway, my website is stevekatzmusic.wordpress.com. And I also, my new album just came out, only a few weeks ago. I just did a first mailing of it, limited edition, and that's on my website also.
This is great. I mean, you're productive. I mean, you're putting out product both to read and to listen to, and you know, I applaud that because so many folks in the same boat just aren't doing it.
I can't really say that my record is product. I basically put it out because I just wanted to do it. You know, after all of these years, you know, I just wanted to put things down, and I'm not looking for distribution or any of that stuff. You know, basically when I do my gigs and I'm out doing gigs now, you know, I'll bring my record, and I definitely bring my books with me to sell for people to get, and I sign it, you know. But it's just a love thing rather than I'm not looking to earn. Well, yes, I am looking to earn
not,
money.
Right?
Please go onto my website.
Why,
you know, who's fooling who here? You know.
Well, listen, let's take the word product out because it makes it sound very corporate when you say, you know, like, look, it's product. But you're being productive, and so many folks from our – well, I'm a little bit younger than you, right? But so many folks from your generation kind of rest on their laurels, and the fact that you're doing something that you love and you're releasing material. I mean, this is something that – I guess went out of style with Def Leppard when they were putting out, you know, hit records every 3 years or 4 years or whatever.
Yeah.
MTV and a combination of that strategy kind of done in the 10-album band. I mean, if you think about it, there's very few folks that are, that have even big bands that you think of now. They got 7 albums, 6 albums, and you look and there's just compilations of their other material. But the fact that you're putting out and you're being productive, I mean, that's a nice thing. And regardless of why you're doing it, it's great that you're doing this.
Well, I'm doing it because that was, like I said before, my love of music, you know, and why I quit school and everything. And that it's just the same thing now. I'm just doing what I feel I have to do, you know, as far as my book, you know, I love writing. And as far as the record, I'm just doing what I feel I want to do. So there's really no difference. I'm not, I am very realistic about the music business and the fact that it probably really doesn't exist anymore. And I don't want to put myself in a competition with young people that are doing some, I can't even tell what they're doing because I listen to the radio. I don't even know they don't say what's being played. So it's very difficult, you know. But I still have a lot of Louis Armstrong stuff that I haven't heard from the 1920s and 30s. So I've got a long way to go before I'm finished listening to great music.
Yeah, well, listen, you and I are in the same boat, and I'm sure a lot of the listeners are in the same mindset that you have and you just expressed right there. But if you think about it, I don't know what's going to happen next. I mean, you know, the majority of the bands that you hear on the radio, I can't even say bands, but the product, that's a good term to use there, is product that you hear on the radio. You're not even hearing drummers. You're hearing, you know.
Well, the problem now is, for me especially, is that there's very little live music left, you know, and so much of it is electronic, and you don't have to be that talented, you know, to press a button, you know. I hope that the next thing that happens, whatever it's going to be, has to do with live music and, you know, another Beatles or something like that would be wonderful. But I don't see it in the near future at all.
No, I don't either, unfortunately. And And as far as you go, and you know, other folks of your ilk, and it's small. It's a you could name a bunch of people, but I mean it's relatively a small universe.
It's getting smaller and smaller. Also, that's why I'm encouraging people to buy my book.
You know, I when I saw your name on social media, I thought, oh my God, this is this would be a great interview, and I don't know if I'm getting older or just more pretentious or whatever, but I'm starting to think it's important to document what folks are doing, and we kind of call it like an audio biography of what we're doing. There's not a lot of info out there on people like yourself and the impact that you've had on the industry. I have to believe that somewhere along the way, somebody's going to say, hey, what about that time period, you know, in between the 60s and 70s and before MTV? You know, what about all of that? You know, what was that all about? And again,
I look back on my generation, and it was the same thing. When people were discovering the old blues artists, and I was lucky enough as a kid to get to meet some of these guys like Son House and Skip James and Mississippi John Hurt, and the same thing is happening here. I mean, people my age, you know, they're in bands. They're people, unfortunately, they're dying. You know, I mean, physically dying. And it's funny because Woodstock is the 50th anniversary. I played at Woodstock. I haven't gotten one call from somebody that said, oh, can you do a call, you know, a talk about Woodstock or whatever. Yeah. Of course, it would only take 3 minutes. But no, I don't remember. I was a little bit, I was wearing white pants at the time, so I don't remember too much.
Steve Katz, once again, is the voice that you're hearing. You know his work from Blood, Sweat, and Tears. And so much more. Lou Reed's producer that really, you know, broke him into the big time, and there's no disputing that. He's a modest guy, but that's Lou Reed's first album. It bombed. I mean, commercially, and I don't know what would have become of Lou Reed the solo artist if it wasn't for Steve Katz. And you can be modest all you want, but I mean I'm not the first to say that. Frank McKay here. With producer and author, the name of the book. Everyone, get the book, "Blood, Sweat, and My Rock and Roll Years" by Steve Katz. You got to get it and go to his website and buy his album as well. And just a wonderful musician and a witness to history. If you don't mind, talk a little bit about Woodstock and I was kind of building up to that. I'm fascinated by what people. Can remember of it, and you know I've had Michael Lang on the show a couple of times, and I everyone's approach to it prior to actually getting there, is somewhat different. I mean, what were you thinking you were walking into? What did you think that this was going to be?
We thought it was just we were booked the year before, and we just thought it was going to be a festival, and it wasn't until that weekend. We heard all the traffic reports that we knew what was getting into, and it wasn't like, oh wow, this is Woodstock, this is going to be fun. It was like, oh God, we got to play this festival in the rain outdoors, probably late at night. This is going to be horrible, and it was horrible. It wasn't a fun thing to do. I also played the Monterey Pop Festival with the Blues Project. That was wonderful. That was great. Yeah. But Woodstock, if thank God, you know, that there were enough drugs backstage, you know, to keep us happy, because we went on at like 2 o'clock in the morning, I think the last night, and then we had to be at LaGuardia the next morning to get a plane to L.A. So, you know, when you have that in front of you, you don't care about, you know, babies being, you know, like born, you know, and stuff like that in the field with 400,000 people. And, you know, it's more fun to play with a smaller audience. That's why I'm loving playing these days, you know, than it is to play for 400,000 people. It's just not fun. It's just like it's like a rehearsal with all of these people watching, you know.
Wow.
So it's just not intimate, you know. Yeah. So Woodstock to me, and this is probably why nobody ever calls me about, you know, doing anything with Woodstock, because I really didn't like it at all.
Well, and what you're honest about it. I mean, there's folks I know that are romanticizing it now that feel exactly the same way that you did while it was going on. Steve Katz, we're coming up on a break. Do we have you for another quick segment?
Sure.
Steve Katz, everyone, is the author of Blood, Sweat, and My Rock and Roll Years. He played guitar for so many different projects, but Blood, Sweat, and Tears is where he'll always be remembered, and you could hear some of the most wonderful guitar work on those albums. And again, as a producer, Lou Reed was a major benefactor of Steve Katz's production talents, and there's so much more we'll get into in a little bit. Woodstock performer Steve Katz is our very special guest, but everyone go to his website and buy the book and buy the record. Blood, Sweat, and My Rock and Roll Years is the name of author Steve Katz's book. Frank McKay here. We'll be back right after this with more from Steve Katz. Hey, we'll jump back in. Do you want to steer me anywhere?
No, that's enough. I'm enjoying your questions.
All right, sounds good. You ready?
Yeah.
I'd like to welcome everyone back to Breaking It Down. Frank McKay here. Much more importantly, guitarist, vocalist, producer, and author. Blood, Sweat, and My Rock and Roll Years is the name of his new book. Steve Katz is our very special guest. New album as well. Everyone get that. This guy has put together an amazing career. Even if you don't know his name, you've definitely heard his music, that's for sure. He's one of these guys. He's in the 1% or the half of 1% in the music business who's put together some legendary things, and in a couple different aspects, not only as a player but as a producer. Steve Katz, once again, the name of the book, once again, is Blood, Sweat, and My Rock and Roll Years. Steve, welcome back.
Thank you, Frank. Good to be back.
Going back to Woodstock, and in prior to the break, you were talking about how it's rainy and it's kind of bothersome. You went on 2 o'clock in the morning, but there's an old George Bernard quote, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit, where he said he didn't like to write, but he liked had written. And in retrospect, I imagine you're thrilled with the fact that you played Woodstock, and again, I shouldn't put words in your mouth, but I mean, if you had to do it again, would you do it again just because of the history of it?
Oh, you hit it right on the head. Yeah, because of the history, sure. It was a historical thing, and to be part of that is phenomenal to look back on it. You know, just because I was uncomfortable for 24 hours doesn't mean that I regret doing it. No, you're absolutely right. I'm very glad that we performed at Woodstock.
How much of what we heard, and again, you kind of give us the opposing view of the romanticized version, but how much of what we heard about Woodstock, for those of us who weren't there and weren't able to get there because of age or because of circumstances, how much of it's true? Even though you had a different perspective as an artist, you kind of have a feel for what's real in the legend and what's not and what's kind of made up. What's real about what we hear about Woodstock?
It's, in that sense, I was hardly there myself. I mean, we got into we flew in somewhere to LaGuardia probably and got into a couple of station wagons. And it was like, getting stuck in a traffic jam. And backstage was fun because we got to, say hello to friends. You know, Steve Stills borrowed my amp for their set. And, the guys in the band were backstage. It was fun to hang out with them, but it was not comfortable when you're on the road, and we were on the road basically, and that was just one of the gigs. Of course it turned out to be more than just one of the gigs afterwards, but, in fact, one of the fun things about it, it's great to go through life, is one of the things is playing at Woodstock. If I ever needed money, what I would do is probably put my fingers on eBay and say these fingers played at Woodstock. But I don't know. I don't think you can do body parts, so I'm not going to talk about that anymore.
Yeah,
but yeah, you go to this very uncomfortable thing. You get up on stage. The stage was huge, and you look out on 400,000 people. You might as well be looking out at a curtain with drawings of people on it. And then you leave. Then you get back in your station wagon and you leave. And that was basically it. So it was pretty boring, actually.
Well, you brought up a point, and you're joking about your fingers, but Well, I think you're joking about your fingers. But if you think about it, everything else that you had on, everything else that you used, Stephen Stills' amp that he played out of, that you lent him, and your guitar and everything else, every necklace or whatever, every one of those things eventually became a gold mine. And you guys probably didn't realize it at the time, but Steve Katz is our very special guest. Everyone, buy the book Blood, Sweat, and My Rock and Roll Years is the name of the book, and you know him from Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and producer of Lou Reed, and so much more than that. But let me.
But Frank, yeah. Frank, since I'm talking about this, if anybody in your audience is interested in a finger that's played at Woodstock, they can get in touch with you, and you can. Anyway, I'm sorry.
Nice,
what were you saying?
Nice necklace. It'll make a nice.
Right. Yeah. Really.
Yeah, but what happened to that amp, and how soon? Having said all of that, how soon did it hit you that this all of this stuff would be collector's item? Did it ever hit you, or was it too late by the time you realized that?
No, we didn't know that that Woodstock was going to be as historic as it was until afterwards. So our roadies just took our amps to the like they would to any gig. As far as what happened to it, I think I probably used it until I left the band.
Oh yeah! Wow. I mean, just think about it. But when did it hit you that hey, this is a big deal. This is a historic thing. When the movie came out, when the album came out, when was the moment?
Well, we weren't in the movie or the album. Actually, it's interesting because we were supposed to be in the movie, but they stopped the cameras because we were booked a year before, and we were supposed to own like 15% of the whatever movie they would make. Not thinking that they would actually make a movie, so they just stopped the cameras. They recorded some of our songs, I would guess maybe 10 years later or something was really when it started, when it never died. The stories of Woodstock had just built and built, and every anniversary, people were starting to celebrate it. And I would say like 10 years after, then I realized, oh, this thing is really. This is really considered like D-Day or something, like one of the big events of the 20th century, which I thought was pretty absurd and still do. But that's what was happening, and that's what's still happening, I guess. I think it's sacrilege to do it again. The fact that they keep doing it is sort of insane because it's just not those times,
Yeah, no, it's forget it. Yeah, it's they should let it die, but they won't because there's a buck involved in it, and they're not gonna give that up. But
exactly, yeah.
If you think about it, Woodstock. I mean, maybe other than the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. I mean, but Woodstock is the moon landing of that time period of the '60s music business. I mean, it's
right, yeah.
It's tremendous, and you're in Monterey's. I don't know where that is, but it's not too far behind, and you played at both of them. That's it's a witness to history. Let me jump back further, and you mentioned as a 15-year-old you were you were in the village and you were hanging out with all those folks. As we know from history, Dylan, made a pilgrimage to go see Woody Guthrie. And I think I saw him in the hospital, it was a big deal. What was your moment? You mentioned a couple of blues artists. Did you have that kind of moment where when you met these folks that it was you reaching out to them, or was it happenstance?
No, it was with Sunhouse and Skip James. It was basically just meeting them. They were rediscovered. With Mississippi John Hurt, I became pretty close with John. We actually spent some time in the same apartment when we were playing the Ash Grove.
Wow.
Together, and that was pretty amazing. And I look back on that, and of course my time with Reverend Gary Davis, Blind Gary Davis, was because I used to drive Reverend Davis around, and actually it's interesting because one of the first gigs that Reverend Davis did that I drove him to was Cafe Lena up in Saratoga, and I'm going to be playing there in 2 nights.
Right, nice.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, that's sort of like really full circle, the fact that that club is still open, you know, and it's a legendary, beautiful place. And I was there when I was, you know, maybe 16 years old.
Well, let me just, again, let everyone know who they're listening to. Steve Katz is the author of Blood, Sweat, and My Rock and Roll Years. You know his work, his guitar work from Blood, Sweat, and Tears and so many other wonderful projects and side work and so forth. His production work, you know, from Lou Reed, and it was his work that...
And don't forget my washboard work with the Even Dozen Jug Band.
Yes, by all means. And again, Steve Katz here with me, Frank McKay, more importantly, Steve Katz. And let me just tell you what kind of career you've had, and I know you know this, but most people's biography would be my time as roommate with Mississippi John Hurt, and you just kind of mentioned it as an afterthought in the middle of an interview. But I mean, think about that. You Mississippi yeah. John Hurt, what he means to music and to guitar and everything else. But you were roommates with this guy. I mean, what was it? What was that like? I mean, what was the experience like?
Well, John was playing the Ash Grove the week before myself and my friend Stefan Grossman, and we needed a place to stay. So Ed Pearl, who owned the place, his mother owned the place, and she was out of town. And so John stayed there, and then we stayed there, and John didn't have any gigs. So we stayed there together. So we spent a week hanging out. Stefan and I we met this kid who was like 17 years old at the time, and we said, "Oh, let's play the gig together," you know. So we became the Gramercy Park Sheiks, is what we called ourselves, and that was Ry Cooter was that kid. So wow. It was the three of us, and there we were with John. And it was fun. We actually watched the Democratic convention together with Johnson, and I remember watching with the ad, you know, and the kid and the atom bomb and stuff like that.
Yeah, the Gold War election.
The 64 election.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and I had some problems. I thought I got this girl pregnant, and I spoke to John about it. And we spent an entire evening, you know, with him making me feel better, you know, with all these wonderful metaphors from his growing up, you know, and having the same problems. He was sort of like my stepdad, you know. He was just a beautiful, wonderful person, and I'll never forget him.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I got to believe what my first instinct is that a guy like Mississippi John Hurt would be like, you think those are bad times? Let me tell you bad times. And then he could tell you about being a black man growing up in the South and what he had to deal with. But he wasn't like that at all, right?
No, there's absolutely no bitterness to this man at all. I mean, nothing, you know. Whereas you take a guy like Son House, who's sort of like a drank a lot, he was nasty, and you could hear it in the music, and you can hear it in John Hurt's music. It's very delicate, beautiful Piedmont blues.
Yeah, you talk about a dichotomy between two.
I'm sorry, it's Mississippi blues.
Yeah, but I was going to say the difference in styles of that genre, Son House and,
right.
and Mississippi John Hurt are polar opposites if you think about it.
Right. Yeah.
Well,
and it had to do with region also. You know, you have people like Elizabeth Cotton, John Hurt, you know, doing that melodic kind of stuff, you know, and then you have the North Carolina style, which is like Blind Boy Fuller and Blind Blake and Reverend Davis, you know, doing more of a ragtime kind of style. And then you have that deep Mississippi blues, which was Son House and Skip James. And that was the really a very enigmatic kind of stuff that really turned my head around, because it's just like, if you listen to Skip James doing Devil Got My Woman, for instance, it's not of this earth. It's just incredible music. And it's live, you know, it's just one guy and guitar, and it's just like amazing.
It's interesting you mentioned Ry Cooter, and I was going to ask you, I mean, at that time period, you know, down in that, in the village, and there a lot of historic things were happening, and I was going to ask you, who were you running into at that?
Well, listen, actually, I should have made that clear. The Ash Grove was in, this happened in L.A.
Oh, when you...
After the jug band, my friend Stefan and I went to L.A., and that's where the Ash Grove was, and that's where we hung out with John Hurt and Rye.
Oh, you see that? Yeah, that's interesting. But
sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. No. No. But let's go back to the Village, because you spent some time there. You spent a decent amount of time in that area. In that time.
No, I lived there for 8 years also.
Yeah. Who were you running into over there?
Oh my God! Everybody. You know, when I first joined the Blues Project, if you walked around the Village, you had like the Love and Spoonful at the Cafe Bazaar, Jimi Hendrix at the Cafe Wah with Richie Havens. They were all passing around a basket, you know. And when I joined the Blues Project, we played the Night Owl with the James Taylor and the Flying Machine and the Magicians. It's Jerry Jeff Walker and Circus Maximus. I mean, wherever you went, there were bands playing, you know, and then the Cafe Ogogo started to branch out, and that's where we became the house band. But they were having more cabaret acts at the time, and that's where Lenny Bruce was arrested.
Yeah.
And then they started booking, Howard started booking rock and roll bands, and the Cafe Ogogo had some of the greatest acts. You know, you walk down there one night, there's a Jefferson Airplane. The next week, it's the Grateful Dead, and we were like the house band. And we got to play with Muddy Waters Band and John Lee Hooker and all. You know, it's just meeting all of these people was, hey, the more I think about it, I think I'm going to read my book again. It sounds fabulous.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, I've got some great memories of those times.
Yeah, well, listen, you're not kidding. Blood, Sweat, and My Rock and Roll Years is the name of the book. Everyone get it. Get it from his website, and you'll get a signed copy. Steve Katz is the author of that book. And Steve, let's get the website right, just so everyone knows where to go, and get it from there and not from Amazon. But go ahead, Steve.
Okay, it's stevekatz.wordpress.com. It's stevekatzmusic.wordpress.com.
Yeah, you'd be lucky to get Steve Katz. There's probably a lot of you guys. There's probably optometrist, you know.
Well, there are other people, Steve Katz. So WordPress gave me this choice, and it was the easiest one I could do. So it's stevekatzmusic.wordpress.com.
No, Frank.
But you know, if you Google me, it'll be on there also.
Now, Frank McKay here with the guitarist, former guitarist, made famous. With Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and so much more than that, producer of Lou Reed and so many other things, roommate of Mississippi John Hurt. How about that? And, Blood, Sweat, and My Rock and Roll Years, once again, is the book you got to get. Got a couple moments left with Steve. Has been very kind with his time here. I love the history. When did you first connect with what we know as Blood, Sweat, and Tears?
Well, excuse me. The Blues Project, which we were together for like 2.5 years, the main part of it, and there's also a guy by the name of Al Cooper in the band.
Yeah.
And Al and I left the band. Al before me, and then we decided to put together this other band. Al was supposed to go to England, and he wrote a bunch of songs, and I was writing songs, and we were listening to. An album by the Buckinghams called Time and Chargers, which had a horn section from the Chicago Symphony. And the horn charts were really pretty interesting, and we wanted to be able to take that on those horns on the road. This is a concept that Al had, even in the Blues Project. So we decided to work together again, which is a total mistake, but it's all in the book.
Yeah.
We decided to work together again, and we hired horns. We hired a four-piece horn section. But the difference, you know, between just a regular horn section was that these guys were great musicians. That Randy Brecker, Fred Lewis, Lipsius, you know, and they brought their personalities into the band. And so it really became pretty special. We did our first album in 2 weeks.
Wow. Well, Bob Dylan did his in a day, but it was just him and the guitar, right? And he did it
right.
In 3 hours. You guys had a horn section. I mean, that alone should take a month nowadays.
Well, we were having a good time. We weren't out for hit singles and stuff like that. We were enjoying ourselves.
I mean, when you were doing all of this, obviously you're doing it for, you know, for a good time, and you've got to make a living. You know all of that. I mean, how soon? And we only got a couple minutes left with Steve Katz. Everyone, the reminder is to buy Blood, Sweat, and My Rock and Roll Years, the wonderful book by him, and you could hear all of this, you know, on your own. Read all of this, and you know his work from Lou Reed, also a producer of Lou Reed. But when, you know, when did it all come together, and you realized, hey, this is, you know, we've made it, or I've made it? I mean, you know, when was that aha moment, if ever?
Well, Al left Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and we wanted somebody, a singer, to replace him that had a great voice and that could, you know, at that point we wanted to get some hit singles. And so we heard, we had auditions, and David Clayton Thomas came in and sang God Bless the Child, and we were just like floored. And we said, well, that's the voice, you know, and it worked. And I felt that the album was very commercial, but not until the first single was You Made Me So Very Happy, the Brenda Holloway song. And Columbia really worked it. They really believed in it. And all of a sudden, that's what started it. You know, it just went up the charts, and my parents were very happy.
Oh, jeez. Listen, I need a part two, part three with you. If I can get you one day, we could talk forever. But everyone,
anytime, Frank, I would love that. That would be fun. I enjoy talking to you. You have an intelligent approach towards you know, the kind of thing I like to talk about, you know, music these days and stuff like that. So anytime, I'll make myself available.
Well, listen, I appreciate that, and listen, everyone appreciates your talent, but. Really, I mean, what a career you've put together. Everyone has to buy this book, Blood, Sweat, and My Rock and Roll Years. Steve Katz is the author of it, and guitarist and producer extraordinaire. Once again, producer of Lou Reed. He put him on the map as a solo artist. And two albums back to back that were just smashes, and you know, critically speaking as well. But Blood, Sweat, and Tears, you know his work from there, and so much more. Steve, congratulations on all the success, and good luck with everything moving forward. Give us the website one more time, and again, you're promising to sign books for them if they buy them there. So
you could buy the new album there also. Let's see. It's called, the new album is called The Juggle, by the way. But the website is stevekatzmusic.wordpress.com.
Listen, Steve, thank you very much for your time. And again, congratulations on everything.
Thank you, Frank.
And I want to thank all of you for tuning in. Frank McKay here. Our very special guest has been Steve Katz. I'm going to say it again just so everyone goes out and gets it. Blood, Sweat, and My Rock and Roll Years is the name of the book, from Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and from his production work on Lou Reed. Everyone has heard his work. You might not know the name connected with the songs, but just a great guitarist and vocalist and producer and author. Blood, Sweat, and My Rock and Roll Years is the name of the book. Frank McKay signing off. Steve Katz has been our very special guest. We'll see you all next time on Breaking It Down.